Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum, and today we're going to talk about risk. Now, in the national security realm, that comes down to lives lost and not achieving our nation's strategic objectives. It's the job of the U.S. military, top civilian leaders, and the defense community at large to ensure that we anticipate the challenges headed our way so we have smart options available. Now, think about it this way. We can never afford to repeat what we saw in World War II. The U.S. military was so small and so poorly equipped that when America entered the war, it took 2 full years before we had enough equipment and trained personnel to really fight completely. 1942 and 1943 were all about fighting to stay alive. 1944 is when we can play to win. No modern peer adversary would ever give us so much lead time again, so we need to manage risk in a far smarter way today. And that's a tough job because changes in the national security environment are stretching the United States to its limits. We've talked about this on the show before. With China and Russia driving threats in ways we haven't seen since the Cold War, adversaries like Iran and North Korea pursuing nuclear weapons and rocket delivery systems, and non-state actors like Al-Qaeda and ISIS continuing to destabilize key regions, there are a few areas where the U.S. can accept risk. And don't forget, this is all happening at once. Add increased militarization of space, cyber threats, and a new modernization surge driven by opponents in the nuclear arms arena, and things become really challenging. Now, two of our top experts at Mitchell, Mark Gonzo Gunzinger and Lucas Outenreed, have spent the past few months digging into this challenge, not just to admire the problem, but to investigate smart solutions. And that's going to be the focus of today's show, talking about the future threat environment and steps the U.S. should take to manage risk in a smart fashion. Now, to host this dialogue, Mitchell's executive director, Doug Berkey, is going to join us. Doug, appreciate you being here.
Slick, you bet. Gonzo and Lucas really hit it out of the park in this one. Their work resulted in a new force planning construct. And in plain English, that means aligning ends, ways, and means so that we have the right set of tools to yield the right options for actors, you know, at the strategic, operational, and tactical levels. So with that, guys, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here.
Yeah, good to see you.
So to kick this off, I want to dial back the clock a little bit. Can you walk us through the past few decades so folks can better understand where we sit today as a military and how this stacks against real-world demand?
Sure. Let's go back to the end of the Cold War, just for a moment. That's when I entered the Pentagon. Cuts to the size of our military really started during the Base Force Review, which Chairman Colin Powell kicked off, but they continued during DoD's 1993 bottom-up review and then nearly continuously to present day. After the Cold War, DoD shifted its focus toward preparing for, you know, short conventional conflicts to defeat regional rogue states like North Korea and Iran. And DoD used that change in focus to justify massive force structure cuts that were also producing that so-called defense budget peacetime benefit. Reality proved different than assumptions, though, very quickly. Within a couple years of the bottom-up review, the continuous pace of deployments, smaller-scale contingencies, they were called, was eating up weapons and other capabilities that were needed for major war, so DoD had to add that to its list as something they needed to increase resources.
So you're talking like Bosnia, Kosovo,
absolutely,
that kind of stuff?
Yep. Northern Watch, Southern Watch, as well. And then 9/11 happened, which created new requirements for Homeland Defense, and then the need for more capabilities to conduct large-scale counterterror and counterinsurgency operations. And today, we have an aggressive China and a Russian government that seeks to fracture the NATO alliance. The point is, all those challenges and threats that I've mentioned, beginning back at the end of the World War, continue to exist today, and our force structure has been cut severely. For example, the Air Force's fighter force numbered a little over 4,100 fighters at the end of the Cold War, and now it's half that size. And that averages out to about 100 per year, retired. And we're only buying them back today at a rate of 48 per year, so the math doesn't stack up.
So what you're saying is all the assumptions that they rolled in with didn't pan out. It did the exact opposite. It ramped on
exactly
demand.
Exactly right.
Yeah. So, I mean, you lived there, Gonzo, during that time period. You were in senior positions in the National Security Council and the Pentagon and all that. What was it like to have a seat in the room while these debates were going on? Because you had to be aware at some level what was going on.
And that's a good way of putting it, seat in the room. Because in the 90s and the 20-aughts, it was a constant fight to ensure that the future had a seat in the room where it happened, or in DoD's case, where the big decisions are made on force structure retirements and modernization programs and so forth. And a lot of the risk assessments that are conducted during that period really focus more on near-term challenges and discussions on reducing or at least balancing current risk or future risk weren't very robust. And that's certainly not unique to DoD. Anyone in business knows that the inbox tends to dominate. There were attempts to shift DoD's agenda towards shaping the rise of China and developing forces for future high-end conflicts with peer adversaries, and that happened during the 2000 QDR and the 2006 QDR, but the resources didn't follow DoD's own rhetoric. And I think many folks will remember Secretary of Defense Bob Gates during the Bush and Obama administrations when he continuously talked about his top priority was winning the wars of today and not preparing for some theoretical high-end war of tomorrow. And we're living with the consequences of that today.
Yeah, now, and I remember being up on the Hill during that period a lot, and you'd darn near get laughed out of the room if you talked about a future threat. You'd be in some Cold War, you know, reminiscent guy, and it was obvious these were coming on a lot of the threats, but people weren't focused there. You know, the frustrating thing, too, when Secretary Gates would emphasize that, look, I get it emotionally. People were dying. It was a very difficult time period. But on the other hand, money Congress, you know, authorizes and then DoD obligates, you don't see the results of that for 5-10 years. So even if you want to fix today, it is fundamentally impossible. You really have to play the long game here. And that's where Secretary Rumsfeld said it right. You know, you go to the war with the military you have, whether you like it or not, it's the truth. So you got to be smart. So Lucas, you've lived through this too. Talk us through how you saw this debate evolve. When did peer competition actually come back to the table and get taken seriously?
Yeah, so I think as Mark mentioned, there were isolated pockets across the national security enterprise that were thinking about future high-end conflict for a long time, but really up through, I'd say, 2008, so much of the attention was on current conflicts. You know, keeping in mind, we were still on the heels of the 2007 surge, so really, that was so much of the focus. I think you start to see some shift with Obama's 2009 Pivot to Asia strategy, but again, that really wasn't backed up with much concrete action or resourcing. You know, I think it really was when Russia annexed Crimea in 2014 and then subsequently invaded eastern Ukraine. I think that was a real eye-opener that shook a lot of people out of their complacency about the real threat of great power conflict, along with China's island building and other provocative behavior in the South China Sea. So I think that really got people paying more attention to what both Russia and China have really been doing for decades, which is steadily modernizing their armed forces, particularly their long-range reconnaissance strike complexes that feature, you know, integrated air defense systems, advanced aircraft, and really massive arsenals of long-range precision strike weapons. So now what you have are two peer competitors with demonstrated hostile intent against U.S. and allied interests and the means with which to potentially achieve it.
And I remember living through that, and you're hitting it on the head, I think. So, Gonzo, I want to get back to you. You know, and you mentioned these terms before, things like bottom-up review, quadrennial defense review, and national defense strategy. Could you walk us through what these assessments actually mean? I mean, it's kind of bureaucratic lingo there, but what does it mean for actually, empowering strategies and all of that?
Sure, and I actually participated, contributed, even wrote guidance for a lot of those reviews, all except for the last quadrennial defense review, quadrennial every 4 years. It was supposed to be an all-encompassing strategic review.
And Congress required that?
Congress required it. The bottom-up review set the template, and Congress liked what they got out of the bottom-up review in 1993, and wrote legislation, said we want that to occur at the start of every administration after that. So we want to see a strategy from Department of Defense, and then we want to know, they wanted to know what force structure and capabilities and budget level is required to execute that strategy at a low to moderate level of risk. The problem is DoD never gave Congress the information they had asked for from the QDRs. Instead of what was required to execute the strategy at low, moderate level of risk, DoD gave them, here's the force that we can size and shape for the budget level that the administration told us to work toward.
Yeah, and let me tie that back. I mean, Mark talked about the fighter force, but you know, you can do a similar thing looking at the size of the bomber force as another example. You know, each review offered a seemingly logical reason for why bomber cuts were the best choice. But the fact is that these and other downsizing decisions grew the size of the disconnect between DoD's strategy and its capabilities. So, you know, going back to the 93 bottom-up review that Mark mentioned, you know, the guidance for sizing the bomber force was 184 bombers. You know, today we're down to 86 primary mission bombers. So does anyone really think that the threat's gotten, you know, less since then? I don't think you'd find someone who would say that's true.
Yeah, and that was 184 deployable bombers, because I wrote the guidance during the bottom-up review for that. And now we're down to 86 fully resourced bombers out in combat squadrons ready to go. I mean, that's a precipitous drop.
Yeah, and as I remember it, you know, Congress got frustrated with what you just said, that it was resource-driven, not requirements-driven. And that's one of the reasons why they sunset Quadrennial Defense Review, moved the National Defense Strategy, and then created the independent panel that we've referenced on the show before. It kind of did an outside, you know, look at it and assessment. And so 2018 and some of the more recent ones have tried to be a little more pragmatic on this and clear-cutting. Could you give us some main takeaways from the recent reviews?
Yeah, so I'd say that the 2018 NDS was as significant to DoD as the 1993 bottom-up review was. I think, you know, it was a real turning point that shifted DoD toward great power competition and conflict and prioritized keeping pace with China's rapidly maturing technologies. And there is some catching up to do. You know, I think it highlighted some important areas such as electronic warfare capabilities, hypersonic weapons, directed energy weapons, which I know Gonzo has a, you know, soft spot for. So those are important. I think the strategy also created a new force planning construct for the services, right? So they are now required to size and shape their forces to defend the U.S. homeland, deter nuclear and non-nuclear attacks, defeat aggression by one major power, such as China, and then to deter in a second region, and then as well, you know, disrupt terror and WMD threats as possible.
Yeah, I'll dig down just a little bit deeper. When the defense strategy talks about defeat aggression by a major power, it really means the U.S. military must be able to project decisive force to halt a Chinese invasion of Taiwan or a Russian invasion of the Baltic states or another area along NATO's eastern frontier. So that increases the need for forces that can immediately take the fight to the enemy and go on the offensive to stop invading forces rather than follow the post-Cold War model of deploying a massive force over weeks or maybe even months and then launching an operation to evict an occupying enemy like we did in Kuwait. We simply can't afford to allow China or Russia to seize, occupy their objective, and then reinforce it and try to push them out.
Yeah. So, you know, you guys said it, new administration's in place, and so I take it a new review is underway right now. And this really cuts to the heart of your report. And so, you know, if you had an hour with Secretary of Defense Austin, what advice would you give him on key considerations that need to be tackled in this new assessment?
Right on top of the list, I'd recommend that the Secretary revisit two assumptions of the 2018 strategy that, frankly, greatly increase the risk of a failure in a future conflict with China or Russia. First, I recommend he revisit the strategy's decision to size the force for a single war, and that breaks with all defense strategies since the end of the Cold War. And second, the strategy assumed a major conflict with China or Russia would be relatively short. Specifically, if we defeat their attempted invasion, then it would cause them to seek an off-ramp toward peace. What would be the circumstances if we only buy enough high-end forces, guided munitions, and other capabilities for a short war, and then the enemy decides to continue fighting? That could lead to a disastrous outcome.
So what I'm hearing here is, it sounds like we're aiming for the world that we want, what's convenient. So let's fight one war at a time. I mean, the fact that we're not sizing for two really seems to take away the deterrent value. How are you going to check an opportunistic aggressor? All that stuff, and like you said, a short war. Well, anybody can just extend it out if that's what they need to do. And so if we give them those cards, that seems really dangerous.
Well, trying to bend reality to your budget assumptions usually results in a failure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'd add a third point, which is that DoD currently lacks joint warfighting concepts to help inform force structure and capability trade-offs that would maximize the joint force's future combat effectiveness. You know, it's been more than 3 years since the last NDS was approved, and the services, you know, in lacking a joint warfighting concept, have been using their own strategies and concepts to guide the development of their forces. And, you know, so when you look at them, you might imagine they tend to protect their own equities, and they're not thinking about it from a joint force perspective. I think the good news is that, you know, they recently reported that the joint warfighting concept may be approved by the end of this month, but you know, I think there's some warning signs already that it may not be what it needs to be. It's because typically the joint staff's bottom-up, consensus-driven doctrine development process, which I might add, they said was not cost-informed, it might reduce its value as a tool to set DoD priorities and make difficult trade-offs.
Yeah, and let me jump on that. I mean, Lucas, what you're saying reminds me of the time when we do the stovepipe decision-making, when during sequestration, we were trying to cut the A-10, the Air Force was, and yet we're buying new Apaches at the exact same time. Yet both do close air support. The A-10 is way more survivable, effective, efficient, deployable, you name it. And yet that was being killed. We were buying the lesser capability that was preserved. And that's just stovepipe stuff. So what I'm hearing you guys say is that the 28 strategy was really constructive. It helped kind of reset the deck. It was far more pragmatic. But now it's definitely time to hone this and to really eat into the core of reality even more. And so talk us through the first issue. I mean, we haven't fought two major theater wars since World War II, and everybody says we're never going to fight Russia or China in direct conflict. So, you know, devil's advocate here. Why should we prepare for both?
Yeah, you know, the fact of the matter is the joint force that has the capacity to fight only one war creates an opportunity for another peer aggressor or even a rogue state to launch an act of aggression in a different theater. Now, I'm going to give you one quote, inflict one quote on our audience, and it came out of DoD's very own bottom-up review in 1993. Quote, "We do not want a potential aggressor in one region to take advantage if we are already engaged in halting aggression in another theater." So what has changed since that was written? The answer is nothing. The logic is as valid as it was in 1993. That's the essence of deterrence. And a one-war strategy erodes the credibility of our deterrence, our ability to deter a second aggressor, be it China, Russia, Iran, or North Korea.
No, and actually, if you look at what's changed, the world's actually gotten more dangerous. And we need that insurance policy, even more, I'd say.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's changed is that our military doesn't have the capacity for a second war today. So we're just not prepared as we were.
Well, and I understand it. You know, when we look at kind of some of the things we're doing in the 2000s and 2010s, I mean, if you look at concurrent operations, Afghanistan, Iraq, stuff going on in Libya, I mean, as I understand it, things are getting pretty thin, and those are all pretty small-scale operations. Did you guys hear the same thing?
That's exactly right. If you look at the Air Force, obviously an area we've studied quite some detail, they actually lack the capacity for a single war with either China or Russia today. And that's just stunning.
Do you see that our aggressors or our competitors are seeing this within us and it's actually incentivizing more opportunistic behavior where they're willing to take that risk because they think we're going to be self-deterred because they're not willing to commit?
Yeah, there's a very troubling trend. I don't think that China or Russia will form any kind of a formal mutual defense pact, but they're talking and they're getting closer, they're sharing technologies, and they have made it very clear that be careful because attack on one, who knows. We cannot dismiss that lightly. We do so at the risk of our own credibility as a force that can deter and assure our allies.
Yeah. So digging into the second area, you know, the need to prepare for an extended peer conflict. This one sounds pretty straight up. But if Afghanistan and Iraq taught us anything, and I just referenced this earlier, you know, an enemy can choose not to lose. They can choose to just continue the campaign and just wear us down. And, hey, let's look at how the U.S. won in the Revolutionary War against Britain with simply not giving up. It can wear down U.S. resolve. So why do DoD planners see it differently? Why are they assuming it's going to be one and done, fast, quick, and work to our playbook?
I don't think they actually see it differently, but they are constrained or feel constrained by budgets and other resource limitations. But I think you're hitting on the head. Let's look at it from China's perspective for a moment. Now, China is well aware that DoD is not buying enough high-end forces, guided weapons, and other capabilities that would be needed for a longer war. And it also knows that DoD is sizing its forces for a single war, so it doesn't have a strategic reserve they can call on as it did in the past. So given that context, if you're China's leadership, what's a better option? Accept a U.S.-inflicted defeat, say your invasion of Taiwan or whatever failed, which would threaten your leadership and maybe even control of the Chinese Communist Party over China? Or continue to fight knowing that you can quickly exhaust the U.S. military? the resource for a short war. And by doing that, eliminate the U.S. military as a dominant force inside the Pacific's first island chain.
Now, I'm glad you said that, Gonzo, because I think too often we project our own values and we don't understand our adversaries are truly looking at very existential circumstances. And like you said, losing credibility with their own population, the Communist Party and all that, that is the biggest threat of all. And so they cannot afford, by that total definition, to toss it in. And in many ways, I'd say North Korea is probably similar, if anything popped off there. And so what I'm hearing you say here, too, is that, you know, the F-22 and the B-2, in many ways, represent very opportunistic, budget-wise, planning assumptions, where we buy such small forces and we think it's going to play out. And the notion of an extended conflict where you're going to need attrition reserves and just the base to run longer continued operations. I mean, it speaks to why the B-21 and the F-35 buys have to be more realistic and just bigger. I mean, do you guys agree?
Yeah, I completely agree. In fact, one short vignette. I was co-leader of the Deep Attack Weapons Mix Study. It was part of the 1997 Quadrennial Defense Review. And that really shaped what kind of munitions DoD was going to buy for a long-range strike. But a second part of that study is not well known. And that's where they took a look at what would be more cost-effective in terms of conducting long-range strikes. It would be bombers, including the B-2, or aircraft carriers, or even Army long-range fires, as they call them. And in fact, the B-2 came out ahead of all of the others in terms of being able to deliver with precision, mass in the battle space, over long ranges. No other capability came close to it. And those results were embargoed because it upset the services apple carts. But nothing has changed. The need for those capabilities today to quickly, night one, night two, take the offensive to the enemy and defeat their invasion is greater than it was back when we were talking about Iran, Iraq, and North Korea.
So bureaucratic equities won, not combat requirements.
Correct.
Well, and just educate me here a little bit. What actually runs thin when we run a long war? What are we eating through? Where are the areas where you see we need to build margin?
Now, the first danger point is in precision-guided munitions. No question about that. We've run short of those in smaller-scale conflicts, and that's a well-known fact. If the fight had to go beyond 9, 10, 12 days with a China or Russia a force that's really trying to aggressively seize one of our allies' terrain or whatever, then we're going to run out of JASMs, LRASMs, anti-ship missiles, and other capabilities that are critical to our projecting decisive combat power. What we have to remember, attrition. I'm happy to talk a little bit more about attrition to our forces as well in a bit.
Yeah. So, and just to highlight here, actually, General Van Ovost, who's the head of Air Mobility Command, actually just published a paper under Mitchell where they're actually looking at having to re-engineer the entire logistics operation, because just to sustain all the flows and everything and do so when under attack is a big thing. So, no, a lot of people are having to think about this. On this next one, I think we've prepped our listeners in past episodes to understand not all weapon systems are created equal, and that better value can be derived through certain investments versus others. So are you telling me that some leaders in DoD are advocating spending more on weapon systems that give us less return value?
Yeah, I'd say, unfortunately, cost-per-effect thinking does not seem to be part of many of the resource debates going on now. You know, I think Gonzo mentioned the deep attack study. I think something similar is actually playing out today. You know, all the services are looking to buy long-range strike capabilities. And not just the strike capabilities, also the ISR and comm systems to sort of do the entire kill chain and to do it for themselves and keep those capabilities as organic assets. And so it appears that, you know, you have all these services that are going after it. So, for example, the Army is looking at long-range hypersonic weapons, which we think would cost probably $40-50 million each. And it appears that no one in DoD is asking what would be the better value, two of those long-range hypersonic weapons, which would be about $80 million, or an F-35 that costs something around the same amount. So,
which you can keep reusing, right?
Right, yeah, and they can fly multiple strikes per day. So, you know, or you can also compare it to weapons, right? You can take two long-range hypersonic weapons or about, you know, 65-plus JASMs or even next-generation stand-in attack weapons. So, you know, do you want to just be able to strike 66 targets or two? I mean, to us, the math is pretty straightforward, but no one seems to be asking that question. It's just all long-range strike is good. That seems to be the attitude.
No, and it's frustrating because, you know, we just got done celebrating Desert Storm and saying how great F-117 was, such a huge advantage because of the value it afforded in the combat space. This seems like huge regression where we're just falling back into equities. And you know, you mentioned the thing about the Army developing its own ISR capabilities, which, as I understand it, is going to largely be space-based. Well, why the heck did we just stand up a Space Force if we're creating these things still in stovepipes? So, no, that is really, really frustrating. So, you know, the good news is that you've got some concrete examples here where DoD leaders can help reset the vectors we're on and better meet the demand. So can you walk us through some of the recommendations that we've hit upon the problems?
Sure. Let's talk about rebuilding the two-war force. Cost is going to be an issue, but it doesn't have to be as costly as some might think, since growth should be selective and based on the predominant forces the commanders are going to need in a fight with China or Russia. As a first principle, we recommend that DoD as a whole, not every service, should have a two-war force. So the next defense strategy should define pacing scenarios that each service should use to size and shape their forces. And a fight in the Indo-Pacific would be air, sea, space, and cyberspace dominant, considering the geography and the nature of conflicts with China. So the Navy and Marine Corps should size and shape their forces primarily for that. And a conflict with Russia and Eastern Europe be air, land, space, and cyberspace domain dominant. So the Army should primarily size and shape its forces for that. And the Air Force, though, should be sized for peer conflicts in both theaters, given that commanders in both will need air forces that can rapidly respond from inside and outside the theater, including directly from the United States, to launch those high-volume precision strikes against invading forces to control the air and perform other missions.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Gonzo kind of broke it down by theater, but I think a similar logic applies for a longer war with China. You know, this would require more air, sea, space, and cyberspace forces and capabilities. It's not really a big boots-on-the-ground type of fight where you need a lot of land forces involved.
I mean, are you hearing this in leadership statements today? Or is Air Force, Space Force, DoD leadership at large echoing this, or...?
No, I do not hear that from the services or from the OSD. The strategic planning processes really are stovepiped. Yeah. The services are allocated a certain percentage of their budget, and then they build their budgets for the next year in a stovepipe fashion. And that's one of the reasons why we recommend that cost per effect and roles and missions assessments, for that matter, inform the development of operating concepts, how the joint force will fight in the future, to work through some of those critical trade-offs that are going to be needed given a flat or declining defense budget to ensure that DoD as a whole has a two-war force, that it can fight a longer war with China if necessary.
Yeah. Okay, what else for recommendations?
Well, let's talk about attrition rates for a moment. I mentioned that earlier. You know, frankly, DoD still uses legacy attrition assumptions and hasn't sized its forces for attrition rates that would be a reality in a fight with a peer opponent. Plus, DoD continues to skew its high-low force mixes towards low-end capabilities. Except for the Army. The Army says, you know, we can't afford to buy new old systems that are not suitable for combat in future threat environments. And I find it troubling that some of the services, including the Air Force, thinks it can. And the F-15EX, of course, is an example of that.
Yeah, and, you know, don't forget attrition. It's not just about platforms. It's also about the, you know, the men and women that man that equipment. You know, DoD simply can't just, you know, crank out, you know, experienced pilots, for example, you know, the way we could during World War II. It's just those people are lost and you're not going to be able to regenerate them. So, you know, if you're looking at certain metrics to sort of see what the right mix is, you can't look at lower flying hour and sustainment costs, which in peacetime may seem like, you know, an efficient way to look at it, when in wartime you're going to end up with a much more significant losses.
And to that point, I would just highlight, you know, you look at today with the pilot crisis, which is still ongoing and it's been ongoing for years. This is during peacetime, with pretty low demand levels,
right?
And we have zero elasticity to surge any growth to meet that. And there's another thing somebody else pointed out to me. In fact, we were talking about it a few podcasts ago, and it's the strategic window of surprise. where it takes, you know, you induct somebody into pilot training in 1 year, but it takes multiple years, even after they get their wings and graduate, to actually get them combat competent. So you're darn near looking at a 4 to 5 year window when somebody's actually useful to you. I mean, that's longer than World War II. And so it's just a huge variable. It seems like we got to get smarter on it and get some elasticity here.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And you know, again, I think also a lot of times when people, you know, run war games and things like that, the assumptions on what attrition rates might be are always underestimated. So it's just something that's not being accounted in our planning.
Yeah. What else?
Focusing on near-term savings and the costs of near-term sustaining the fleet and training the force and so forth is extremely short-sighted. You have to look at the costs if you actually fight a war. The operational costs, the costs in terms of platforms and crew, soldiers, sailors, etc., that's lost. And China knows that calculus, and it is preparing accordingly. Strangely enough, we do not seem to be. We seem to value peacetime savings and, frankly, near-term readiness over preparing for the kinds of conflicts we've been talking about.
And I would assume some of that preparation is also just with the industrial base that, you know, it's kind of like I just talked about with pilot training. They, too, have been squeezed so hard in many ways. Their ability to surge and build those stocks rapidly would be pretty limited.
Yeah, 2 points. We've heard from senior leaders in DoD talk about, well, our forward bases are really optimized to be extremely efficient to generate sorties and conduct other missions in peacetime. They're not defended by air and missile offenses against the kind of salvos that can be launched at us by China and Russia, and even in Iran, as we've seen. The same thing with our defense industrial base. They've been so squeezed for dollars over the last 30 years, they've become incredibly efficient. But by doing so, they've eliminated their surge production capacity. We simply can't double or triple the rate of advanced munitions that they can crank out that we would actually need in a real fight with China or Russia. Well, they can do it. It'll take them 8 months to 12 months or even longer.
Yeah,
and that's way past the time you'd need them.
I get it. And, you know, I'm glad you referenced that Iranian missile attack on our forces in Iraq. We've talked about this, you know, as a team. It is unconscionable, in my opinion, that was just kind of let go. The fact that we had hours, if not days, of warning that something was going to happen, and we had zero recourse, yet to just sit there and take it. And there hasn't been a call to look into this. What were the failures? How can we avoid it? I mean, that was nothing. That was a very mild message in a very dicey situation where both sides are watching escalation. I mean, if China or Russia were coming after us, I mean, it'd be game over. Don't worry about shooting down a B-21 or an F-22 in the sky. You're just going to blow it up on a ramp somewhere, or the fuel stores or munition stocks, whatever. I just don't get this.
Yeah, and I think that kind of points to another set of recommendations that we have, which is that, you know, we talked about, you know, the services are kind of protecting their own equities, but what we really need is strong DoD leadership to sort of help set who's going to do what. So what we really advocate for is you need sort of a selective roles and missions review to talk about who is going to be responsible for air and missile defense, who's going to take that mission on. You know, you mentioned space as well. There really needs to be a consolidation of a lot of those different, you know, services and capabilities within the Space Force. So those are the types of things that we think that DoD really needs to look at and sort of provide more top-down guidance to the services, what they should be prioritizing. So that, again, that they're not all going after the same mission, like such as long-range strike or others, that they, you know, is sort of the shiny object of the day.
Yeah, air and missile defense is a great example. The Army has a mission in the Pacific. We're not saying that. Air and missile defense is one of them, clearly, and training with our partners and allies and so forth. But air and missile defense is an area that the Army is responsible for, and they haven't even funded enough capabilities to protect their own forces, much less our forward air bases, ports, logistics terminals that they will also be dependent on. And I simply believe that if this administration can tackle that and resolve that by looking at what would be more cost-effective, what would actually yield the greatest jump in combat capacity forward. Is it allowing the Army to buy a handful of very expensive weapons? Or is it defending the air bases so we can crank out the combat sorties in the volume the theater commanders are going to need?
Where's the resistance? I mean, this is so common sense. Why hasn't this already occurred?
DoD has not had a real roles and missions review, even a focused one, for, well, decades, maybe since 1994. And it's high time to do that, because the real efficiencies to be had is by taking a look at the division of labor for some of these critical missions. What service can best provide the capabilities needed by theater commanders from a cost-per-effective basis, and do so in the volume that theater commanders are going to need, rather than saying, well, let's revert to Little League rules where everyone should contribute equally, or everyone should be able to have the ability to defend themselves and conduct long-range strikes and do the... That's incredibly wasteful. And we simply can't build a two-war force, or one that can fight a longer war, if we continue down the path DoD has for decades.
So what I'm hearing you say is there's resistance because people are worried about they might lose portions of their authorities or budget or whatever. So they're worried about kind of what might happen versus the future they could realize, which would probably be overall way more effective and efficient.
Yeah, another way of looking at it is the Navy, the Army, frankly, are still on the path towards developing all the capabilities they will need to fight the way that they believe they should in the future.
Alone, not alone. With the team players.
Correct. And that is not jointness.
Yeah.
The Marine Corps has the right idea. It says we no longer should be a second land army. We can contribute to controlling maritime spaces in the Pacific by funding shore-launched anti-ship cruise missiles and doing other things. And they're divesting tanks and towed artillery and other capabilities that the Army can provide better than they can. And that's the exact right approach.
No, I appreciate that insight. Hey guys, I just want to wrap this up here, and you hit on it already a little bit, but I think it's really important here. You know, the constant retort in D.C. is, well, what's this going to cost? And I get it. There is a budget, but we need to look at it the other way, too. You know, what's the price of inaction when it comes to your recommendations? What happens if there's just more status quo?
Status quo is not going to address reduced readiness rates. The lack of capacity that we have, frankly, across the force. It's not going to address the threats that China and Russia pose to us. Again, we talked about air and missile defenses. I mentioned attrition in the context of combat attrition for air forces in particular. But the greater cause of attrition will be attacks on our air bases in the Pacific, in Europe, and in the Middle East. And that is something that people have talked about, but they're not doing much about. We've got to do that, or the recipe for the future will frankly not be pretty, should our assumptions again prove untrue.
And I would just add, you know, I think that the people who focus on that, they just think of the possibility of a conflict as being so remote that they're willing to take that much risk. But, you know, just look at the situation in the Taiwan Strait, right? I mean, they keep moving up the timeline on when China might be doing that invasion. I think if we continue to, you know, underinvest in our military, you know, that's just going to move the timeline up even further because they feel prepared that they can actually win. That's what effective deterrence is all about, is investing the money in order to make sure that they don't feel like they're going to be able to win.
So what I hear you say is, in the context of Hong Kong, this is really, really an imperative because there are possibilities at play here. And the other thing I think it's important to consider is, for the last 20 years, we effectively lost Iraq and Afghanistan in slow motion. And yet it wasn't something very tangible for many here. Obviously those that had personal loss of service members, it was a horrific thing. But as a country writ large, it didn't change the way we lived. What you guys are talking about are wars were fundamental core interests that change the actual way in which we live, our rights, et cetera, are on the table. And I'd say it's probably closest we've seen this since the Cold War. And it's just accelerating in many ways.
Yeah, the last 20 years really has set the table for the future. We've heard in the past where, well, the force is at its peak readiness because we just came out of this conflict and we know how to operate together, we have the right capabilities and so forth. But that's not what is happening now, coming out of the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan. The force is not modernized. It is too small. We have the resurgence of great power competition and potentially conflict. And the force is not set for that. So there's a lot of work to do to frankly, build that future for us.
Yeah. Well, Gonzo, I've got a last one for you. You know, you began your Air Force career as a B-52 pilot, and at one point in time, you know, let's face it, your mission was to fly into some of the most dangerous threat environments on the planet. You know, talk to me about what all this means at a personal level. You've been there. You've had to make that hard decision to strap into a jet knowing that it is going to be really bad. How does that shape how you approach a report like this?
Well, I'm going to tell you how old I am, because I was 20 years old when I first started flying the B-52, and the remaining fleet is now 58 years old. B-52s, of course, are going to fly to 2050, according to the Air Force. So the mission for the B-52, which I flew, changed from a high altitude penetrator to a low altitude penetrator, you know, fly low and under the air defenses of the Soviet Union. But now it's a standoff bomber because it can no longer penetrate contested areas defended by air and missile defenses. The problem is survivability, as you noted. We knew that we could accomplish our mission, even though the risk was significant. But we also knew there was a very good chance that would be our final mission. And the cadre that trained me fought in Vietnam. And several had crewed B-52s that flew strikes around Hanoi during the famous 1972 Christmas bombing campaign, where 10 B-52s were shot down. Another 5 were lost due to battle damage. And remember, Vietnam was a third-rate military power, not China or Russia. So my real takeaway from my experiences in the operational world is that our men and women in the armed forces will always be ready to do their jobs when the country calls on them. But we should never ask them to fight with capabilities that are not suited for where they're going to fight, the kind of threat environment that they will operate in.
Yeah, no, I get it. It's really important stuff. So I really want to thank you, too, for being here today. These are huge issues. I really hope that folks in the building on the Hill respond to this. It just seems like we cannot run the clock down any longer. It is time for some real change. And you talk about those losses of the B-52s in Vietnam. That was in 12 days. And yet here we are still debating, well, do you really need stealth or things like that? Those are the experiences that scared the heck out of our defense leaders, that we needed these things. And the threat has only gotten worse. And so I think it's time we put some of those arguments to bed and just get on with the reality. So, guys, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, again, thanks for having us. I really appreciate you having us here and looking forward to continuing the discussion.
So, you know, Slick, we don't really launch a report here at Mitchell unless we think it's very relevant. But I got to be honest, this one is going to be really important. And so we can talk about planes, missiles, satellites, you know, as individual things. And that's fun. It's interesting and all that. But they're just tools. It takes strategy and operational concepts to realize their real value. And that all rests upon understanding the threat environment for what it is, not what we want. And so really appreciate you letting me take the mic today to explore these topics. With that, over to you.
Thanks, Doug. I really enjoyed the conversation. And I really appreciate Gonzo and Lucas for being on the Aerospace Advantage today. I'd also like to extend a big thank you to you, our listeners, for your continued support and for tuning in to today's show. If you like what you've heard today, don't forget to hammer down on that like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. You can also leave a comment for us to let us know what you think about our show or areas you would like to hear more about. As always, you can join in on the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn, and you can always find us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Until next time, this is John Slickbaum. Stay safe and check six.